Today's Tay Show will be on Case 10 in the Pien Lu, the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 10 is entitled Bokushu's Empty-Headed Fool. Engo's Introduction. Yes is yes, no is no. In the Dharma battle, each stands on his own ground. Therefore, it is said, when one's activity is upward, even Shakyamuni, Maitreya, Manjushri, Samantabhadra, the thousand holy ones, and the religious teachers of the whole world become silent and spiritless. When one's activity is downward, even maggots, gnats, and all creatures become brilliantly illuminating, and as independent as a 10,000-foot cliff. However, how is it when one's activity is neither upward nor downward? If there is any rule, rely on the rule. If there's no rule, follow a precedent. See the following. Main subject. Bokushu asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk gave a katsu shout. Bokushu said, "This old monk is shouted down by you." The monk shouted again. Bokushu said, "What about the third and the fourth shouts?" The monk stayed silent. Bokushu hit the monk and said, "You empty-headed fool." Secho's verse, two shouts, three shouts, the knowing one knows well. If going hell-bent, both are blind. Who is blind? Fetch him. Expose him to the world. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning on this beautiful spring morning. Only a few weeks ago, it was still freezing, and the trees seemed quite far from being ready to send forth their leaves and flowers. In fact, as you all know, we've had a very cold spring, and it was below freezing only about 2 weeks ago. I got up one morning and went outside to put some bird seed in the feeder, and I noticed ice in the bird bath. So it's quite cold. And now all of a sudden, in about 2 weeks, everything has exploded into life. When we were walking out of the UC Stone Hall complex last night toward the parking lot, I suddenly noticed that all the trees were in leaf. The crabapple trees had just exploded, not only flowers but leaves, and even now the maples are out in their leaves, and at night it looked like it could be, some of the trees looked like it was, they were so fully leafed out that it could have been June. They were so so thick with growth. And this is just in 2 weeks. It's so exciting after such a long, cold spring to see summer finally arriving. And it's certainly not a new idea, but there's a powerful teaching in all of this. You know, a few months ago, everything was so gray and looked so dead and inhospitable. And, you know, February is such a rough month in so many ways because, you know, you drive around and you look at the trees, and the trees just look absolutely dead. And the forests are gray, the sky is gray, and it's cold and uninviting outside, you know. And it just seems to stretch on interminably. And it's like, when will spring come? It's this endless winter. And then, you know, spring comes, it always comes, you know? And when it comes, it's such a shock, because everything seems so dead and lifeless, and now everything's exploding with life. So many times in our own lives, you know, we've all had those interminable Februaries, you know, where you just think, will this ever change, you know? And we've all had experiences where we've just sort of been reduced to holding on, you know, just holding on. And maybe no energy, everything's gray inside, you know. And so, you know, we see this explosion of life, and it's like a teaching, you know? It's like somewhere on the other side of all that grayness, and on the other side of all that death, and all that coldness, there's this warmth and this life springing up. And it's really springing up out of us too. I think that's so wonderful to see. It's like a lesson, you know, have confidence. Everything changes. Everything changes. And life is like the law of the universe, really. So, you know, have confidence in things. You know, this is very important. Last weekend, in the New York Times, there was an interesting article that Kriti put on the blog, on our Cold Mountain blog. She made a reference to it, a link to it. And I've been thinking about putting it on the on our reading list. I might make an illegal a copy and make a link to the illegal copy. I don't know if the New York Times will come after me. I think I'm too small. They'll come after people who steal one song these days off the internet, but I think they'll probably leave me alone. And it's such an interesting article because it was entitled Enlightenment Therapy. And I highly recommend it. If you read it, it will, it might make you uneasy in certain ways. And I actually think that's a probably good thing. You know, sometimes you have to take medicine that has a harsh effect on your system, you know? Sometimes there's, you know, in America we like medicine that's very sweet, you know. So if you have a cough, you can take cough medicine, and really what it is it's corn syrup mixed with some other ingredients that might help relieve your congestion. And in pills too, they put a lot of corn. Everything has to be very sweet. But there are some medicines, you know, that are bitter. When you take them, and they're bitter going down, and they might actually be hard to deal with, you know, your system might have a hard time. But afterward, after the medicine has gone through your system, you know, you're actually healthier. And I think that's quite interesting. And some things in life are like that. You know, we have to do them, and they're hard, and they're difficult all the way through. But when we're done, we're better, you know, we're better. And I think this article is sort of like that. Because a lot of people have misconceptions about Zen, you know, and about Buddhism in general. And one of the misconceptions is that, you know, I've talked about this before, people come into the Zendo and they want to try meditation because they think it will be like maybe bliss, right? You know, if you ever go into Tibetan temple, all over the walls there's pictures of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas floating in space, surrounded by beautiful mountains, and they're up in the blue sky on these magical cushions. And you think, wow, I want to float up in the blue sky like that, you know, that's really cool. And, you know, bliss, right, bliss. And indeed, when people sit down on the cushion and watch their breath, it can be a tremendous relief, you know. People are so distracted, so frantic, and their minds are so fragmented that they just go from one fear to the next, you know. And so some people come in to sit down on the cushion and they watch the breath for half an hour and they feel instantly much better. I think this is what happened to me. It's one of the reasons I really got into meditation, because, you know, I began to feel better right after I started doing this. You know. Last night we had a young woman who was a very nice young woman. She came in here to sit, and after about 5 minutes she started moving. And she kept moving for the whole 25 minutes. And when somebody moves like that, that's not a physical issue. That's a mental issue. That's somebody who has a lot of distractions, you know, not in control of her mental processes at all. And so I felt very sorry for her. She's very, very, very distracted. And for such a person, something like yoga or Tai Chi would be much better than meditation at this point. Because, you know, if she moves and focuses on her motion, it will help to give her one-pointedness of mind, like mental focus. But right now, that's quite out of the question when she's sitting on a cushion. So if I ever see her again, I would definitely recommend something like meditation or yoga to start. Maybe seriously, in 5 or 6 years, she could try meditation again if she did yoga quite faithfully. But some people are not in such a difficult situation, and they come in and they do meditation, and right away they feel better, right? And you're more relaxed, you're calmer, some of that heavy weight is off your shoulders, and it's quite a relief. And then if you keep practicing, you may actually have sits where you experience real bliss, you know, really beautiful, the beauty of samadhi. Samadhi is such, when we stop living so much in our self-centered consciousness, and we begin to step outside of non-dualistic awareness, you know, separated from the things around us, it really is a kind of bliss. It's just beautiful. It's like everything is so wonderful. And so it's possible to think that meditation and Buddhism is like a bliss, 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 bliss. However, you know, as I've often talked about, when you sit on the cushion, sometimes it's not bliss, it's hard work. You know, you encounter your karmic obstacles, and you have to keep going into mushin or into your breath and working through those karmic obstacles. And it's quite important to do this, quite important. It's possible, I suppose, to practice in a way that doesn't confront those obstacles. So if something's bothering you, you might just push it aside and say, well, you know, that's not important. That's not quite the same thing as working through a problem. You know, a number of years ago, I had a crisis in the writing program that I direct. We had to cut about $300,000 from our budget. And I had to fire 10 people. This really happened. Now, we have about 25 full-time employees in the writing program, and they're all very good. They're all selected because they're outstanding teachers. They're all hard-working. And I had to let go, as they say, of 10 of those people. And I had to call them into my office and say, listen, you know, you've done a fantastic job, but I have to, quote-unquote, let you go. And it bothered me enormously. Right? Because I know these people personally. Some of these people started working with me when they were graduate students. You know? And now they're postdocs or something like that, and they are finishing dissertation, or they're either postdocs or they're finishing dissertations. And of course they need this income. Some of them have started families and things like that. So it was just heartbreaking, you know. So, you know, when something like that happens, if you're a human being, right, it can bother you. It should bother you, you know, because it's a troubling situation. So I have to confess, I would wake up in the middle of the night sometime troubled by this, you know. I felt very sorry for these people I cared about. And when I have these kinds of problems, what I do is get on the cushion and I sit, you know, I do zazen. So I would get up sometime at like 3 in the morning. I usually get up pretty early, but I would get up even earlier. And I would sit down on my cushion and I would do a couple of hours of zazen. And maybe I would start sitting with like very agitated heart. And then little by little, I would, you know, I would go into deep mushin. And at the end of the sit, you know, I would be calmer. My mind would be calmer and not aching. My heart would not be aching so much. I would sometimes think about what I could do, you know, how I could get out of this problem for the future. You know, so in other words, instead of being paralyzed by the situation, I could help myself to become calm enough to be constructive. You know? And in fact, over the next 4 years, I rehired every one of those people. So I did fix it. You know, it took 4 years, but I fixed it. I've tried to take precautions to make sure that they wouldn't ever be vulnerable in this way again. Although there's no guarantees. But that's a real life, you know, crisis. That's a real life problem. Now, you know, I could have sat down on the cushion and said, well, you know, this is just red dust. This is just unimportant. Everything changes, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. And at any rate, you know, this is a small self. I don't live in the small self. I live in the large self. That wouldn't be the right way to deal with the problem. You know, actually, the small self and large self are not two. When we still make that distinction, we're like at an intermediate state in our practice. First we're in the small self, then we do zazen and we begin to enter true nature or big self. But eventually we realize, you know, big self and small self are not two. You know, so another example of this is A number of years ago, I had published an article in a leading journal in my field. And it was a very controversial article. I knew it would be controversial. But I really, it was really something I believed, and when it came out, I was very proud of my work, you know. And I expected to be attacked, but about a year later, I got the journal, and I opened it up, and inside was a lead article by a friend of mine, a woman named Minjong Lu. And I noticed on the first page there was my name, and I said, "Oh, good, you know, she's talking about my work." But it was just an incredible attack on me, you know. And so, you know, basically, I read it, and it bothered me very much. And of course, like anybody else, I have a capacity to be self-deceptive, right? Like anybody, I want to insulate myself from suffering so I can tell myself the falsehoods sometime, right? So I said, "Oh, well, good thing I've had Daikensho, or this would really bother me." Good thing I don't live in my small self, right? But see, that was a big lie, right? That's a big lie. And so, you know, sooner or later I had to admit to myself that this was causing me a lot of pain. You know, I had expected to be attacked, but not by my friend. And I had, and it was quite an attack. It was like, wow, that is really, it was like on and on, you know. Okay, I'm dead, you know. But, the thing is, it hurt a lot, you know. So I had to do a lot of zazen. And a number of years later, I met her at a conference. And she was so conciliatory. She actually, I think, felt badly about what she had written. And it was very important. It's like, that's like a karmically important moment, you know, when somebody who's maybe injured you, you know, she might have just been speaking the truth as she saw it, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that, you know, so people can disagree. Even if she was vigorous about attacking me, that's okay. I should have a clear heart, you know, so I had to really work on that. So her motives weren't bad. Her motives weren't bad, you know, people disagree. But later, I think she felt sorry maybe about the way she had treated me personally. And she, you know, asked me to go out to lunch. And basically, it was very important to have a pure heart in my encounter with her. You know, not have any bitterness. And not have to fake it. You know, not like a fake smile. You know, like, "I'm so glad to see you." People can usually see through that. But you can see through that, right? So it's like, this is a zazen test, you know. You have to have a clean heart. And so we're cleaning up the heart, cleaning up our hearts all the time. Get rid of any anger or bad feelings or small, petty reactions, you know. So this is really what zazen is all about before Daikensho and after Daikensho. But people don't always understand this. You know, a lot of time in Zen practice, Daikensho is so valued, and it's quite important. You really are changed by the experience. But it's so valued that people think, well, you know, when I have Daikensho, all of these problems will be gone. You know, I have problems now, but I don't have to deal with them, because if I just keep sitting, I'll have Daikensho, and then I won't have them anymore, right? Everything will be revealed. Right? And anyway, in this article, this Enlightenment Therapy, it's about a person who had Daikensho very early in his training. And it really, what he describes is what most, I don't know for sure, because I don't know how long the experience went on. But what he describes sounds very much like a kind of classical Dai Kensho, Great Awakening experience. And he had it very early in his Zen career. I don't know, about 5 or 6 years, 7 years in, something like that. Maybe earlier. But the thing is, he became a very screwed up person. And the article is all about the fact that, he's in his early 60s now, and really was having like a nervous breakdown, sort of like, and had to go to a psychiatrist who also studies Zen and practices Zen. And the psychiatrist had to help him through his crisis. And one of the things he said was, you know, that he had, that this person who had gone through the crisis had to say was that he always felt, you know, I don't have to be a small self. I don't have to be a small self. You know, that's a small self concern. I just live in the big self, right? And so really the article is so valuable because it's like, frankly, don't let this happen to you. You know, this is like how not to practice Zen. It's a common misunderstanding of Zen practice that we don't live in the small self, right? I mean, it's important to be in your big self, but as I say, big self and small self are really one and the same, and you can't really develop big self, big mind, true nature, without also living deeply in the day-to-day world and in the problems of your small self. I wanted to read you something because it's by Hakuin Zenji. I got up and I had left this book in the other room and I wanted to read it. But Hakuin Zenji is actually writing about what happens after you achieve Dai Kensho. And he says, let me read you a little bit of it. This is so important. He says, even so, while as a newborn child of Buddha, the initiate enlightening being reveals the sun of wisdom of the Buddha nature. In other words, after you've had Dai Kensho, he said, still, the clouds of karma have not yet been cleared away. Since your power in enlightened mind is still slight and your perception of reality not perfectly clear, he said, this state is like the dawn. Enlightenment is not the culmination, it's like the sun coming up in your life, but it's like early morning. You have to go through the day, you know. So it's like the sun rising in the east. Although the mountains, rivers and land get some rays, they are not yet warmed by the sunlight. Though you see the way face to face, as long as your power of shining insight is not great and strong, you are prone to hindrance by instinctual and habitual psychological afflictions, and you are still not free and independent in both pleasant and unfavorable circumstances. So without further cultivation after enlightenment, many people who see Dharmakaya, enlightened mind face to face, still miss the boat. And so he says, let me just go on a little bit. that he says you have to keep working from enlightened mind back into the world of form. And he says, when this work, when you're on the proper path, he says, when you see something, shine through it. When you hear, shine through what you hear. Shine through your own body, sensation, perception, action, and consciousness. Shine through the six fields of sensation. In front and in back, to the left and the right, through every sort of upset and all kinds of downfalls, enter samadhi in radiant vision of the whole, seeing through all things internal and external, shining through them all. When desire arises, you shine through desire. When anger arises, you shine through anger. When folly arises, you shine through folly. When the poisons of desire, anger, and folly cease to infect your mind so that it is purified, then you can shine through the pure mind. He says, in that state of deepest realization, this does not mean non-dual merging into a homogenized view of formless sameness. It's very philosophical. What he says is, don't think that in enlightened mind all differences are gone. He says, everything becomes, he says, I remain Hakuin, you remain Bill, you remain Susan. But he says, everything exists in absolute equality. All things become absolutely Buddha and absolutely equal. So there's not, I guess that's clear in itself. It's like after a Dai Kensho, you're still Kurt, you're still Ray, there's a difference because also Buddha, also enlightened mind. And in that state, everything exists in a kind of perfect equality. All things are important. So, for an enlightened person, how he puts his shoes down outside the Zendo is big deal. Big deal. It's possible to say, it doesn't matter, they're just shoes. Right? That's just the realm of form. Actually, not so. How you put your shoes down is very important because actually, as we say in Zen, your shoes are your true nature. Everything is part of your body. Everything is your... Another way to put it is, everything is your responsibility. See, it's very difficult for people to take responsibility when they first start doing Zen training because, at least for me, I used to screw up so much, I would screw so many things up and I would get so nervous, because I would think about screwing up. So, I used to work as a carpenter. And one of the things I would have to do is read blueprints, which I cannot do, So, on several occasions, somebody would come and give me blueprints and say, this is what I want. And I would go, well, let me just ask you some... And as I would ask questions, they would get more and more impatient. Maybe they couldn't read the blueprints either. They're actually very hard to read. And actually, many people in the construction industry can't read blueprints. And I myself don't have a very good spatial intelligence, So reading blueprints is very tough for me. So I would have to put some walls up on a cement foundation. And I would take my chalk line and snap it, and I would look at the blueprints and measure it all off, and then I'd put it up, and then the guy would come back and he'd go, that's not right. Didn't you read the blueprint? And I'd go, oh yeah, or I'm making it something. And then I'd have to tear that down, and this happened all the time, and many things in my life were like that, where I was, I would screw things up, you know. And when I got to graduate school, same thing, you know. I can remember just thinking, oh God, you know, if I could just get through graduate school, everything would be okay, you know. I just know somehow I'm going to screw it up, you know. And I was very nervous. I made myself like very nervous all the time because I was just waiting to have some screw up occur, you know. Zen helped me a lot, you know, because it kind of took that weight off my shoulders. I began to be able to just trust, you know, a little bit more. You know, being in samadhi helped me to be less afraid of things. And when I could trust, you know, I actually did better, you know. You know, when you're very nervous, it's hard to think. I don't know if you've noticed that, but if you're very tense, it's hard to learn and it's hard to think. And so, you know, one of the reasons I would have a hard time reading blueprints is because I would be tense about it, you know. I have, you know, benefited greatly from Zen because, you know, when I'm less tense, I can understand things more easily. And often much more creative. Tension isn't good. Some people, I guess, benefit from tension, but not me. You know. So in a way, you know, early in your Zen practice, doing Zen is so liberating because it says, look, you know, just let me take this. Zen sort of says, let me take this weight off your shoulders for a while. Don't worry about the outcomes. You know. And that's excellent. You know, that's very important at a certain stage. But later in your practice, when you become like mature practitioner, you know, and after Daikensho, it's sort of like the opposite situation where you feel, you know that you can't control things, but you also feel responsible. You have a sense of responsibility, you know. So if somebody's in pain, you feel their pain like your own pain, and you feel like responsible for trying to do something. You know, so that's a more advanced state. You can't you have to take it one step at a time. But anyway, I guess this person in this article really didn't have a chance to read and understand what Hakuin had to say. You know, that Daikensho is really something that is quite important, but you shouldn't put off resolving your problems until then. In fact, working through your problems is really the way most people get to Daikensho. And then after Daikensho, you still have a lot of work to do, but it's a very beautiful way to live. You know, it's very beautiful. Now, you know, a lot of people, Daikensho or awakening is a central element of Zen practice. There's no getting around that. You know, the model for our thinking about this is what happened to Siddhartha Gautama. He practiced seated meditation until he had his awakening experience. This is like the model for all of us in the Buddhist world, right? We're emulating the example of the Buddha. And indeed, this is what he told us to do, what he taught people to do. In the sutras, in the Pali sutras, people have awakening experiences, and also in the koan collections. But it's very important not to be like, it's important not to put off your solving your problems until this great event. It's also very important to pursue something with patience. So if you go to every sesshin and you say, this is it, I'm going to have Daikensho or I'm going to kill myself, you know, that's like bad spirit, bad way to practice. You know, most good things in life take a long time. You know, They take a long time. Most good things in life take time. And so patience is very, very important. Second teacher, Webb Roshi, was a really wonderful man. He went to Japan because he wanted to study art. He wasn't interested in Zen. He was an art historian at the University of Chicago. And his PhD research was on a particular Japanese artist who did a very famous painting. It's an Inca painting called the Five Persimmons. And it's at a temple. It's at Myoshinji. And basically, I believe it's at Myoshinji. And Webb went to the abbot, and the abbot said, well, maybe it was at Kenkoji. I guess possibly it was at Kenkoji. And anyway, the abbot said to him, I won't let you see the picture unless you do Zazen, because unless you've done Zazen, you're not equipped to look at the picture. So you can't really understand it. Don't even try to write about it until you've really gotten into deep samadhi and mushin. So anyway, Glenn did indeed, his dharma name is Kamgan, cold rock. Glenn did practice Zazen for many, many years. And he finished his training, and the teacher allowed him to see the picture. The teacher said, well, I'll let you see the picture. Glenn went into the bathroom, and next to, they don't really have a toilet, they have a hole in the floor. But next to the toilet was the painting, the scroll, you know. And basically it was next to the shitter, as we say. Yeah? So the teacher's sending a message to Webb about not being too concerned about great masterpieces. And also beauty and these things all go together. Webb never had Daikensho the whole time he was in Japan. He completed all his koans. You can do that. You can work through all the koans, and that shows that you really deeply understand the way. You have taken it into your flesh and bones. Right? You've been polishing yourself and transforming yourself, but this psychologically decisive event hasn't occurred yet. And so at the end of his training, his teacher Miyauchi Kenko Roshi said, I would like you to take over the temple here in Japan. And they went to India together. They went to India, and they also went to China. They went to Hanshansi. But Webb really didn't want to take over the temple because he hadn't had Daikensho, and he felt like a big phony baloney. You know, I like that expression. He felt that he wasn't authentic. So one of the reasons he didn't accept this teaching job in Japan was that he hadn't had Daikensho. So anyway, his teacher said, okay, fine, when you go back to the United States, why don't you, you know, teach people how to do Zazen? And so Webb started a Seattle Zen group. And he did teach people how to do Zazen, but he didn't really want to teach Zazen as like a Roshi, because he hadn't had this experience. And so he brought a teacher named Hisamatsu. Hisamatsu Roshi came from Eheiji and led Sesshin for a while, and then he invited Genki Roshi. And the interesting thing was that Webb had his Daiken show at in Seattle at one of our sesshins when I was just getting started. It was like one of the sesshins we had. Webb had the Daiken show there. In fact, he and Hisamatsu Roshi had it at the same sesshin. And I wondered why they were crying so much all the time. They were acting very strangely. So that's a little bit of history. It took a long time, you know, many, many years of training in Japan, and then years of training. But it's not as though you know, you just have nothing and then you have Daikensho. You know, basically, every time you go to sesshin and you sit for 3 or 4 days in deep mushin, you know, you have an opening with your koan. Usually, you know, you finally have, like, your mind opens up a little bit, and then it closes up a little bit, and then you go to another sesshin, it opens up a little bit, and then it closes up a little bit, and this goes on and on for a long time. But, So, you know, good things take a long time. So it's very important to enjoy the path, you know. That doesn't mean that every sit is going to be bliss, right? But you know when you feel like you're doing the right thing with your life. You know, I like to jog. I have arthritis now, so I can't jog as much as I used to. But not every jog was bliss, you know. Some jogs were really murder. You know, sometimes you go out and it's hot, but you know, after it's over, I like to get exercise, because after I get exercise, I feel so good. You know, just feel, after a good run, you know, you feel so pure and clean. Your mind is calm. You know, it's a really nice feeling. So it might be difficult while you're doing it, but afterwards you feel good, and you know, this is what I like to do. This is what I want to do. So I think it's important to have. To know this is my path. You know, I love this. It's always, sometimes it's difficult. You know, sometimes I say I'm not going to move a muscle for 3 sits, and on the second sit I have to move. You know, and sometimes I sit right through 3 sits, and it's not a problem. You know, that all goes with the territory. Sometimes you're really in the groove, and sometimes you're in the groove right up until the last 5 minutes, and you know, that all is, that's okay. You know, but you know, this is what I want to do. This is my I love this somehow. You know? And then time is not so important. It's not so important. You know, if you're thinking 5 years or 10 years and I'm out of here, you know, that's not a good spirit. That's a problem in itself, right? I mean, actually, there have been people in our group who sat for like 8 or 9 years, and then they didn't have Daikensho, and they said, screw this. I must not have been a good teacher, because I need to communicate that this is like a way of life. You know? Because, you know, Daikensho is the goal, you can't neglect day-to-day life. You know, in fact, you can't get to that point without living skillfully. So, you know, I get up every morning and I sit on the cushion for an hour and a half or 2 hours, and then I go to my job, and I have all kinds of frustrations during the day. And I don't say, oh, these don't matter, you know, because you know, these are not, these are petty concerns, mere human concerns. You have to deal with them. You know, people's lives are at stake. People come in to complain about something, about their grade or something like that. You have to treat them with respect, you know. And there's always, you know, dilemmas. You don't know, did I do the right thing? You know, that never goes away. But, you know, usually there's this great feeling of connectedness to things, the unfolding of life. And the other thing is that, you know, practicing Zen is like being a stone in a bag of stones, you know? I love that. There's a Roshi whose name is J. Joshu Sasaki Roshi. And, you know, he recommends, he talks about how valuable it is for people to belong to like a community of practice, like a sangha. And when people get in a sangha at first, you know, I mean, it's really unusual to meet people who want to live this way, really. People who are drawn to this path are rather rare and should be treated with great respect and affection, because, you know, a lot of people don't get it at all, you know. And if this speaks to you, that's quite wonderful, and meeting other people like that is quite wonderful, you know. When people first meet other people in this sort of a setting, everybody is wonderful and so on and so on. But, you know, if you live together with other people for a while, or you go to a lot of sesshins, you know, people can do things that start to piss you off, you know. So, people start to annoy you, you know, that, you know, and you probably annoy somebody else too, you know, during sesshin, you know. That guy, he's always breathing hard, you know. People come to the dokus, I can't stand it, he's the wind, do you hear that? You know, it's like, what, you know, can't you hear that? It's like a train coming through the zendo. It's like, no, I didn't hear it, you know. Or somebody will come in and say, oh my God, everybody's moving, you know. And it's like, I look around, I don't see anybody moving. I hope they're not, but I don't really care, you know. But, you know, things bother people, you know. So it's like rocks in a bag, you know. You put a bunch of rocks in a bag and you just let them rub against each other for 10 years, you know. And the odd thing is, you know, actually they begin to get very smooth and shiny, you know. And that's like Zen practice, right? All these things that bother you are like polishing their mirror, you know? They're like polishing the mind. If they're approached in the right way, all of this is like rice, right? It's like cleaning your mirror, you know? And polishing your mirror, your mind, polishing your life. Zen is all about, nothing can be accomplished without patience. Nothing can be accomplished without discipline. Discipline. You know, people who practice Zen are self-disciplined. And, you know, that means you set the clock for 5 o'clock, you know, and if you can't get up with 1 clock, you have 2 clocks. If you can't get up with 2 clocks, you have 3 clocks, you know. Really, I have 2 clocks. You know, one is next to the bed and one is on the dresser. So if this one goes off and I go, oh, then the other one goes off. All right, I'll get up. You know, and I sit down on the cushion, I'm tired, you know, but once I'm up, I'm up. I might as well sit. And that's discipline. Yeah? But I don't necessarily like the word discipline because it sounds like punishment. You know, it's very important to be kind to yourself. Discipline doesn't mean being unkind to yourself. Discipline doesn't mean setting like unrealistic standards for yourself. You have to take everything one step at a time. I like the word cultivation, self-cultivation. It's like my mind, I'm an artist, you know. My mind is my medium, is my art. And I work at it every day. It's like cultivating, growing plants in the ground. You know, it's like pull the weeds out every day. If you don't weed your garden, it gets full of weeds. You have to cultivate your life. So I think this essay, this article was so instructive because I think this person was practiced incorrectly. He didn't cultivate. He put all his eggs into the Daikensho basket. And then when he had Daikensho, he didn't know what to do with it. He didn't follow Hakuin's excellent advice, right? Hakuin says, don't run from your problems. Shine through your problems. Fuse enlightened mind with your problems. And what you can do is fuse Mushin with your problems. Fuse Mushin with your challenges, you know? And then everything becomes bearable and lighter. And you have this sense of, you know, sometimes life can be totally crazy, But, you know, it's like you can stand back and just say, you know, I'm so happy to be alive. I feel such joyous energy in the midst of all this madness. You know, it's very rare for ordinary people to do this, but people who practice Zen can sometimes do this, you know. You know, I've sat down on the cushion sometime, you know, and gotten off the cushion actually laughing. You know, sat down in tears almost and gotten off the cushion laughing. And when you can step back from it all and you just say, this is like a great adventure. You know, this is my great adventure. This is all unfolding, and I can't make it unfold the way I want, but I have the ability to respond constructively or destructively, right? And so I'm going to take responsibility for my own mind and my own life, and I'm going to respond constructively. And the key is mu, it's mushing. So then life becomes, you know, life is always going to be crazy. It's always going to be nuts, you know? But you can live it with real joy if you put mushin at the heart of your life. So please be an empty-headed fool. Yes? Bokushu asked the monk, where are you from? The monk gave a katz shout. Bokushu said, this old monk is shouted down by you. The monk shouted again. Bokushu said, what about the third and fourth shouts? The monk stayed silent. Bokushu hit the monk and said, you empty-headed fool. Now that's a compliment. So you are quite a cultivated monk. Very good work. So you're doing an A. That's the Zen way of saying you're doing an excellent job. See? You empty-headed fool. Two shouts, three shouts, the knowing one knows well. If going hell-bent, both are blind. Who is blind? Fetch him. Expose him to the world.